Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. And in today's show, we have one of the most inspiring people that I've ever met. Her name is Jill Fullan. You may not have heard of her, although if you were at the Outlaw 2017, you most definitely would, because Jill won the Outlaw outright that year and set a new course record. So, welcome to the show, Jill.
Thank you, Simon.
How are you today?
Yeah, good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Now, let me just give the listeners a little resume briefly. It's not time ordered or anything, but this is some of your achievements in your triathlon career, which I believe started in 2009. So in that period of 9 years, you've been to Kona twice, to the Hawaii Ironman World Championship. You've been World Triathlon Corporation 70.3 Ironman half Ironman champion in 2015. You were winner outright of the Outlaw in 2017. You've won gold medals at every distance of duathlon, sprint, classic, middle and long, and you've won world championship medals at middle and long distance triathlon as well. Okay, spectacular resume, and one which I'm sure many people would be extremely proud to get a fraction of. But on top of that, in 2016, you probably had your biggest defeat, followed by your biggest victory, which was the biggest defeat, obviously finding out that you being diagnosed with cancer. And then shortly after that, well, not shortly after that, but after that, then beating the disease and then coming back to the sport of triathlon for that victory last year. And when I tell you about Jill, I don't like to make a thing about age, but Jill is in her 50s. Right? You wouldn't know that if you were watching her compete or to talk to her. She has the enthusiasm of people 20 years younger. But I just wanted to put that in perspective, because for somebody of Jill's age to win an event like the Outlaw outright is a superhuman achievement. So if you hadn't already got the idea that Jill was superhuman, and I'm sure she's blushing with her modesty at the moment, then you surely should now, and you will do by the end of this chat. So, Jill, I'm humbled that you've joined us today. And what makes it more so is that this is one of our anniversary issues. And we had a vote amongst our listeners, and they were all thinking about pros, but I really wanted to introduce them to somebody who was totally inspirational. So let's go. Let's see if we can go back in time. And tell me about what you've had an amazing triathlon career in such a short space of time. So what were you doing before then? Were you some sort of running prodigy or cycling prodigy?
Definitely not. No. I did a fair amount of cycling as a sort of teenager, because that's the only way I could get about, like a lot of teenagers. But I really didn't do anything specific or clubs or structured. I was sort of fairly active, but apart from that, nothing specific. But I've ridden horses since I was about 11, and that's always been my main passion.
And specifically, because I didn't mention that in the introduction, riding horses competitively or just for fun?
Yeah. Well, it started off for fun, and then I actually ride professionally at dressage.
Oh wow! Now that's a tough sport. It doesn't look very tough, because you see the rider sat on the horse, just looks like it's ambling around the.
We hope it doesn't look like it's ambling.
Well, it doesn't look very energetic. So for it seems like a paradigm, not a complete opposite of. In a diametric opposite of triathlon, where it doesn't look that energetic. But you're going to tell me now, and for all of the uneducated listeners who are like me, that dressage is actually hugely complicated and extremely difficult to master.
It's incredibly technical. It's really, really technical. It's ever so difficult. So if you think about how technical swimming is,
yeah,
and then multiply it by about a million, and then add another person into that equation that you're also trying to communicate with, who might have completely different goals to you, and you have to end up doing the same things and looking as if you're, you know, doing nothing to achieve the goal, you can get some idea of how technical and tricky it is.
And of course, that other person you refer to is one that can't speak. So yeah. I guess you have to be able to pick up other signals.
Yes, there's the communication is a big issue, and that's what it comes down to in the end: communication, balance, coordination, all of those things.
Wow. And just going off tangent a bit, have you found that by communicating with a horse and being able to pick up signals other than listening to, you know, somebody speak, do you find that's improved your communication with humans in general in life and your ability to to work out what's going on? Body language, for instance?
I think I get on far well better with horses than people, to be honest. My communication with the horses is far better than with people. I get on with them very well.
You've never been coached by Brett Sutton, have you, by any chance?
Yeah, well, not directly, but I have been out to camps where Brett has been, yes.
Because he has a history of working with horses and dogs, doesn't he?
It's really interesting, actually. He has talked about that, and he's had a lot to do with racehorses. Mm. So actually, my coach, Perry Agas, when he heard I had a horsey background and I could get him into a racehorse yard as well, we spent a day with him watching my dressage antics and him going to the racehorse yard and watching a very good racehorse trainer train the horses. And they had a very good conversation about the similarities and differences of training horses and training people and methodology. And it was absolutely intriguing. And that did all come from Brett.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've often wondered if that's why Brett's what has made Brett such a good coach is he has people in a group. So he's obviously able to see them every day, which does help. I know that from, you know, working with Jack and Malcolm in Leeds. But if you can look at somebody walking, or you can assess their body language, the way they're, you know, the way they're talking, looking at their eyes, if you can pick up those non-verbal communication signals, that gives you a whole lot more information to work on. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think absolutely that's right.
It's interesting that you say that Perry went with you to the racehorsing yard. Fiona and I were introduced to Mark Johnston, mm-hmm. who's up in Middleham, who's one of the most successful jump horse coaches, hurdles and steeplechase. And we spent a day with him up there, and we had the same similar fascinating conversations about, you know, how you train horses, what happens when they get injured.
Yeah,
it seems very much like a polarized way of training, is that they're either cantering out or they're absolutely galloping, but they don't do what we would call a lot of threshold work. So it's either very steady, you know, even just walking. So when he moved to Middleham, one of the things that he did, which was quite revolutionary amongst all the other trainers, was that he had all of his jockeys walk from the stables up onto the moor where the ancient running tracks are that the Romans had, and all of the other trainers used to drive their horses up, and his argument was, well, if we wanted to build endurance and strength in the legs, why wouldn't we just walk them up? Then they can just do a few gallops and bring them back down again. And everybody thought he was mad and he was going to be overworking the horses, but once he started getting results, everybody started looking at his methods and changing what they were doing. But fascinating similarities.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting. I often think when I'm doing my speed efforts, I think back to the racehorses galloping up the hill and think that's what I'm trying to do. And the aim with them was to just, I mean, horses will, you know, they'll gallop and they love galloping and they'll give you everything. And then when they're tired, they literally stop. They go, right, I can't do that anymore. And that's what I have in my mind when I'm doing my speed work is, right, I've got to gallop and give it everything I've got. And when I've got nothing more, then I've got nothing more. But each time I'll go a bit further.
And it's interesting this, because this whole thing about animals really fascinates me. You know, the horses don't ever look at each other in the paddock and worry, oh, he's got a great saddle, I'm gonna get beaten by him today, or his jockey's got good colours, clearly he knows what he's doing. The horse just likes to run, and they're pack animals, aren't they? So when one's running hard, the other one will run hard, and it's very difficult to pace them and to slow them down. They'll just do what they do well.
Yeah.
you know, they don't cross the line pressing the Garmin that they've got on the edge of their hoof to see what time they did. They just like running fast. And it's interesting you say when the horses were running uphill, was that just a phrase, or was that a deliberate action from the trainer to have them?
No, they train on the hill. Their gallops go up the hill.
Yeah, well, that's what Mark said as well. He had two 800 meter runs that they did, and they would go uphill because it builds leg strength as well.
Yeah.
And then they would walk back down so that the horses aren't going, come on, we need to get back now, I'm recovered, let's go again. They just walk them back down the hill until they're fully recovered, and then they do two. And I think that was all they did in their training ever, was just two flat out 800 meter efforts, which at the speed they run would be what, 30 seconds, 20 seconds? Yeah.
Wouldn't be very long, would it?
No, so it's not a lot of work, is it? It's true polarized training.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like the HIIT stuff, isn't it? You do go absolutely mad and then stop.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so riding. Were you doing anything else then besides the dressage?
When the boys were little, I took them to a karate class in the village to keep them busy. And actually, having sat there for a year watching them, I finally got persuaded to go and join in. I may as well be doing it rather than sitting and watching. The other problem was that by the time they got to black belt, I was having trouble getting them to bed. So I had to go, I had to train myself, and I got to black belt in karate, first dan. So I did enjoy that.
So you are one of life's high achievers then?
I don't know about that. I might be just one of life's most aggressive, not sitting still people.
what sort of level do you compete at in dressage then? Because we know we're probably all aware of Charlotte Dujardin and her antics at the Olympics.
Yeah.
So, where would you fit in that sort of?
I've competed against Charlotte. Okay. At the minute, my horse is at Prix St. George going training towards Inter One, which probably doesn't mean a lot, but it's the level where you get to wear a top hat and tailcoat, which is very nice.
Okay, very good. So you're talking about Premier League dressage then?
It's getting up there.
Cool. Okay. So in 2009 then, you started out on this short but amazing triathlon career. So what prompted you to take, because that's a complete about turn, you know, going from dressage and a highly explosive sport like karate, but obviously one with lots of discipline. What was the impetus for getting you involved in the sport of triathlon?
Well, I used to run a training stables, and we came to the end of our lease, and we actually moved out into a normal house. And I found the notion of sitting on a sofa a bit alien, seeing as I'd worked like 24/7 for the last 10 years with the horses and, you know, with the kids to bring up and everything else. I hadn't sat still for 10 years and I wasn't about to start sitting still. So I needed another outlet. Although I'd still got the horse, you know, the horse near the house, but just not the yard to run. And I'd always liked the idea of triathlon. I'd sort of looked on from afar and thought, oh, that looks fun. That looks like something I'd like to do. And some friends of mine in Scotland had put together a relay team to do a rat race event, which is, you know, the swimming and the mainly mountain biking, I think, and running. And it's had all sorts of checkpoints where you had to do various activities, and I thought that sounded like a lot of fun, and they said, well, come and join our team. So I thought, oh god, well, if I'm going to do that, I better get a bit fit. So I came home from visiting them in Scotland and found the local starter tri event was a super sprint in Bedford Park, and there were three of them in the year. There usually are three of them. And I thought, well, if I do them, that'll be a good start to getting me fit to do the rat race events with my friends. So I just started, I was taking my son to diving at the time. So I started swimming while he was diving. I'd just go running from the house, and I got on my very, very old bike that I'd used to cycle to uni and back and started riding that a bit. And that was how it started, really. So I did those three sprints in 2009, and you just get horrendously hooked. I mean, it's horribly hard work while you're going round. And I think that first one, it's a super sprint. And I remember seeing all the people around me and walking out of the changing rooms at one stage and seeing this guy who was just sort of mooching home for his breakfast. And I looked and said, "You do this just before breakfast as nothing, don't you?" And he said, "Yeah, pretty much." And that was all my life had been building up to for the last like 3 months. And it was this huge, huge thing for me.
Yes.
And I thought, there's a lot more to this than I thought.
Ah, okay. So and how did you get on in those first races? Obviously well enough to make you want to go back for more, or was it more about the taking part than the performance?
Yeah.
That's a leading question.
Yeah, I did pretty well. I mean, I wasn't winning. I did get placed in my age group, I think, not on the first one, but on the sort of second one. I remember stalking the other ladies in my age group and thinking, well, they weren't that far ahead. Goodness, if I can do that on the back of, you know, not knowing what I'm doing, then what can I do if I actually do a bit of training? So a friend of mine had just joined Bedford Harriers, and she said, well, go to the Harriers because they do lots of running. So I joined the Harriers, and that was, well, I mean, that was the end of life as we know it, really. It's a fabulous club with loads and loads of people doing loads of mad things. And they were just coming up to their 25th anniversary, and they wanted 25 people to do an Ironman. Well, I mean, I haven't got much resistance at the best of times.
So from your start with these super sprints in 2009, you took the plunge and went completely to the opposite end. And did you do your first Ironman in 2010?
Yes.
And what happened?
I did Nice.
Nice. Oh, okay. So you started one of the tough ones as well then.
Yeah. Yes, amazing. Just an amazing experience. The training leading up to it with a bunch of sort of like-minded people and getting absolutely knackered at the weekend and challenging your safety zones and your thoughts of what you could do was just amazing. I mean, we went out to recce the course, and I went out with people I didn't know very well, and I remember getting halfway around the bike course and, you know, stopping for a drink of water or something and saying, but I've never done more than 50 miles. How did you even think I could get it around this course? What made you think I could do this? And they're like, ah, yeah, we knew you could do it. 112 miles later, we plopped in the sea and I went, yeah, I could do it. That's amazing.
So did you find that you took to all three sports quite easily, or did some prove to be a bit more challenging?
Because I'd been doing a bit of running with the club, I was okay. I knew I was okay at the running. I didn't think I was anything particular. I still don't. I can run fairly naturally. I've always liked riding the bike, and that was, like I say, my mode of transport as a youngster. So that came fairly naturally. The swimming, I still struggle with. It's getting better. But, I mean, I love swimming. I've not got a problem with it. Don't have any hang-ups or issues with it. I'm just not quick.
No. Well, I think part of the issue is if you're comfortable in the water and if you enjoy swimming, you've overcome most of the demons that most people come into contact with, haven't you? Because it's that fear and that worry. So if you enjoy it, that's probably enough. And you probably aren't that far out of the way of the other girls in your age group. And if you're a demon on the bike and on the run, then I'm sure you catch them up fairly quickly.
That's the plan.
So what was it? How did Ironman Nice in 2010 work out for you then?
Yeah, it was it was amazing and awful at the same time. I went in the sea a couple of days beforehand, and they just had horrendous floods. Although it was a real heat wave, they'd had some real big flash floods that had washed a lot of rubbish into the sea. And I remember swimming through some dubious things and thinking, this doesn't look very healthy. Although the water, you know, generally was obviously beautiful in Nice in the bay. And when I got to the race, I quite enjoyed the swim. Actually, it was mad. It was more like my karate black belt grading than a swim, but probably why I enjoyed it so much. Got out the water and I literally couldn't take on anything, whether water or fuel, for the rest of the race. I just kept being sick or feeling nauseous. So I literally did a 11.5-hour Ironman on bits of water that I could bear to take.
That's you. You were. It sounds like you were one of the flag bearers for the keto movement. There, there aren't. There won't. There won't be many people that have, by design or accidentally, done an Ironman distance with no fuel. You've proved it can be done, which is what everybody that does keto says anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sort of coming back to that in a way now as well. I've always done a lot of fasted training and so forth. And I think you can teach your body to find fuel from your own reserves.
Oh, well, that's something we should maybe come back to towards the end then. So you were 11.5 hours. So you were, did you cross the line thinking never again? And then the next morning wake up and think, oh, well, hold on a minute. If I'd actually felt all right, I could have done a bit better there.
Pretty much came over the line, said, don't ever make me do one of them again. I remember I was sort of almost hallucinating and it was seriously hot running down that big, long promenade in Nice. And
there's no shade at all on that road, is
there? No shade, and I'm not hydrated enough, and certainly not fueled enough. And I was quite well, almost ready for it, I suppose, my first one. But I remember running along there thinking, I just want to be home with my children and my horses and never do this again. Yeah, but of course, within 24 hours, that's all gone.
Yeah. I guess you didn't qualify for Hawaii on that debut then?
No. No, I think I was fifth. I remember trying to count people's bracelets as they was going past, and they were, you know, in the end, I couldn't tell whether someone had one on or five on. I was that far gone.
Okay. Was it on your mind that you might qualify for Hawaii there, or did you just want to do the Ironman distance and be done with it?
Oh, people had joked with me that I'd go and qualify first time out. I didn't really think it was probable or even possible, to be honest. I just wanted to finish.
So Nice comes around the end of June, doesn't it? So did you manage to fit anything else in that year, or was it on to 2011?
No, well, when you do your first one, life stops, doesn't it? Life stops at the date of your Ironman. That is all life is up to that Ironman. Everything is completely obsessively about that. And afterwards, we don't plan anything because you don't think you're going to be alive after that. I think I came back from that and did a lot of random running races and set a lot of PBs because the fitness I had from the Ironman and from all the training I'd done for it gave me incredible speed. So I actually came back from that feeling brilliant for running, certainly. And then looking to what I could do the next year, really.
And at what point did you first get your first qualification to represent Great Britain or go to a major championships?
Well, that was 2010 was Nice. So 2011, I found I must have qualified at Nice to go to the long distance tri worlds in Henderson, Nevada. So I went and did that the following year. Yeah,
another hot race.
Well, you say that.
Was that the year when they had bad weather? Did they have to change it?
It was. They had torrential rain the day before, like they never have. Everything was flooded. And then they had snow overnight as well.
Henderson's just outside Las Vegas, isn't it? Because Henderson Lake's one of the ones that feeds Vegas, yeah.
And they hadn't had snow for years and years and years, literally decades. And we woke up to the news that the swim had been cancelled because it was too cold. And all the rainwater had flooded the lake, and they couldn't guarantee it's, you know, what was in there now. So the swim was actually cancelled.
Interesting, after all the furore over Ironman UK and how the organisers should have budgeted for wildfires on the moor, it's the same as expecting the people of Las Vegas to budget for flash floods when they haven't had them in most people's lifetime.
Absolutely. I mean, I was devastated because obviously when you've trained for something, you've got that in your mind, that's what you're going to do. And I put loads of work into the swim. At first I was like, oh no, that's awful. And I can understand how people would feel about Bolton when that's your big goal and you've got that in your head that you want to do it and you want to get through it. I absolutely understand that. But at the same time, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't you know, not have had the wildfires just for Ironman UK. That's
no, and like I guess
snow.
You know, I chatted to Ian Hamilton just before the Outlaw, and we were talking about the challenges that race directors face, and you know, one of their biggest goals is to make sure that everybody comes back to the race venue and to the finish line safely. And if people don't make the finish, or if there's a bike crash, you know, I think people think that the race organisers just put it down as part of the race, but I can tell you that Ian and Adam feel the pain of the people who've crashed and been injured as much as the people who've actually got the injuries themselves. And they're you know, if something serious happens, I know it's a devastating sort of black spot on their mind.
Well, it's a personal responsibility. You've put the race on. You know, there's some responsibility there. I know through helping out at Harriers, we put, you know, quite a few races on, and you feel it. You do feel it. You feel it as a personal slur on you if someone has a problem.
Absolutely. So, okay. So, I talked earlier about this. We probably haven't talked earlier about this amazing triathlon resume. Probably haven't got time to go through each of it in turn. Tell me about the sort of training that you did then, because what I want to do later is get a comparison with pre-cancer and post-cancer in terms of the amount of work that you do. So what did a weekly training program look like for you, and roughly how much volume were you averaging on a week?
That's really difficult, actually, because I started off with a local coach who is a lovely, lovely chap, and he really prepared me ever so well for Nice, and I stayed with him the following year as well. So we did the pretty standard build up, you know, starting around 10 hours and getting up to about, I don't know, 18, I suppose, of all the normal mix of long things, short work, speed work, you know, brick sessions, really fairly, I'm going to say fairly standard. It worked really well. It was very good. But it wasn't exceptional. It wasn't different to what anyone else would have been doing, really.
And are you quite resilient as a in terms of your framework, or do you tend to pick up injuries easily?
I had a lot of running related injuries. The swimming and the biking obviously aren't quite as detrimental, but I've had a lot of leggy type injuries. Usually at the end of every season, I was having to have like a month off to get over something. But when I decided I wanted a break from being coached after a couple of years, because that was sort of dominating my life, and I thought, oh, do you know, I just want to go and have some fun and do some other races and do some other things. So I went and had a couple of mad years where I just went and did absolutely everything. Every race I wanted to do, I went and did, and I had heaps of fun, and I did a lot of racing. And to be honest, my results weren't bad either. I just went and had a lot of fun.
That's an interesting thing, because we talk a lot about the enjoyment of doing the sport, and how a lot of people seem to be guided by what they think others are doing, or what they think they should be doing, and what the Garmin says, and it's all gadgets and the fun. You know, you see people running, and they don't look to be having an awful lot of fun, to be honest, when they're racing some people. And I'm forever fascinated, and at the same time saddened, when I'm commentating, to see the number of people who cross the line looking disappointed with something, or you know, looking glum afterwards. And it gives me great heart when I see the odd person that's smiling and has had a ball, and you say, well, how was your race? Fantastic, I had a brilliant time. They're not bothered about the time. It's the time they did. It's the time they had that's more important. And it's sort of like a drug addict, you know, you get lots of lows, and then you get this one high occasionally, which keeps you going. And that's it for me.
I have to say, it's usually me at the end of the race going, God, I could have gone faster. I could have done this different. I could have done that better.
But I bet also you're still smiling as well, aren't you?
Oh, do you know, I've got a club mate who's done 31 Ironmen, and she doesn't do them particularly quickly, but she does them really well. And her finish photos are a thing of beauty. She always has the biggest smile. This is Eva Kovacs, and smiles brilliantly. And her finish photos are, I am so jealous. We have this constant thing where I say, Eva, yet another brilliant finish photo. And she says, Jill, if I could get your speed, I wouldn't mind not smiling. So we need to learn from each other.
Sometimes, though, you know, if the most immediate thing you've got to reflect on is that photograph, I think I'd rather have one that was smiling than looking glum.
Definitely. But I'm sort of trying to survive by the end. I'm not thinking about the photo. Thinking, oh, please bring the finish line closer.
Absolutely. Let me just ask you, do you feel that riding has contributed to any of those running injuries in terms of the way you have to sit on the saddle, the way you use your leg muscles for riding? Don't think so at all?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
In fact, because of the slight pressure you have down through the stirrup, it's great recovery on your Achilles and hamstrings because it just gently stretches them. It's very sort of therapeutic. It's quite good. And it's great for balance. It's great for core. It's just a very good all-round exercise. And so for self-awareness, body awareness, you've got to be so balanced and coordinated and aware of where you're tightening and where you're not. I mean, I also teach riding, and I'm always dealing with people who are crooked or don't have a lot of self-awareness or a tightening and so forth. It makes you very body aware.
And of course, the horse can pick up on anything that you do. The horse picks up on it and responds to
Absolutely.
It, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I was watching a film the other day, and these guys were riding along this sort of edge of this cliff, and one of them was looking over the edge, and the guy who's in charge of them said, don't look over. If the horse senses that your body weight shifted to there, that's where it'll go. So you have to look where you want the horse to go. Don't look to the side.
Yeah, luckily they've got a bit of self-preservation about them as well.
Yeah. Okay, so just to repeat then, during that time from 2009, you got selected, you qualified for Kona, you won the world 70.3 championships in your age group. But then in 2016 you had some real bad news, and you got diagnosed with cancer. So let's just talk about the lead up to that. Was it just that you were ill and you went in for some tests, or did you have an inkling that there was something wrong for a while before that?
Absolutely nothing, none of the above. I had my season planned. I'd got a lovely season planned ahead of me. I was really excited because from Kona the previous year, I'd qualified for Boston Marathon. So I'd put in for that. I don't run marathons, but I thought, you know, if I've qualified at Kona, I fancy the idea of going to Boston, I'll do that. I'd got two duathlon, Europeans and Worlds, Ironman 70.3 Worlds again, and Barcelona Ironman. I'd got that was my season. And in the February, I got called for a routine mammogram. I'd never had one before. It was to be my first one. And I actually had a dressage competition on the day they called me. So I rang them up and said, I'm sorry, I can't come. which I subsequently thought, you know, my priorities weren't quite right there. But within a month, I went and had it. And they recalled me. And I got the recall letter and thought, yeah, loads of people get recalled. It's pretty standard. It is with smears and stuff. I've been recalled and nothing's happened. So I didn't say anything to anyone. I just sort of carried on life and went, oh, yeah, I'll just go for a recall. That's fine. And it was only sort of driving down the motorway towards the Luton where they have the specialist clinic. I thought, I'm sure it's nothing, but what if it is something? And I went, no, it won't be anything. Put it out of my mind. and then it was something.
Wow. And so what was your immediate response to that? I mean, devastation, I suppose. But as a triathlete, did you think, well, I wonder how long it'll be before I can start racing again?
No, my brain doesn't work like that, really. It was completely in denial. But I have to say the process... for me anyway, it never started off being really dreadful. It always started with something little. So what they found first was some just little calcification in the breast, which a lot of people have. It can be completely harmless. And with my season planned out, I said to the nurse, well, look, yeah, there's this site calcification that could, in theory, in 5 to 10 years, possibly lead to breast cancer. So actually, there's no huge hurry for me to have anything done with this. I'll get to the end of the season. I'll do my Ironman. I'll come back in and we'll talk about what we can do then. And she's like, oh, well, yeah, maybe that works, you know. And so that was where I was. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to worry about this. I'm not going to stress. It's fine. And then I think I got a running injury. I had a suspected a stress fracture. So I stopped running and I thought, you know, if I'm not running, maybe I ought to just get this looked into now. Because if I need something done, I can have the treatment while I'm off running. Like, it's a typical triathlete, this, isn't it? Just put all my injuries in one basket, deal with them all. And when I come back, you know, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
So I went and had a second opinion. And very, very fortunate for me, my husband has private health insurance through his job. So I went to see someone and he said, well, yes, it's calcification, but actually, do you not think we ought to just check that that's all it is before you put this off till the end of the year? So I went and had an MRI they checked my lymph nodes as well. And that's when it got serious, because they found it was more than calcification. And one of my lymph nodes also had cancer markers. So that's the point where it was pretty obvious that the year wasn't going to go as planned and I was going to have to I still didn't can any races, actually. I was still like, yeah, I'll get this done. It'll be fine. I won't have to cancel anything. I went and competed in Spain. I went out to Aviles and did the Duathlon Worlds.
Was that before your op or after it?
Before, and I did Copenhagen long distance duathlon, and then I did Boston as well, the marathon, all the while knowing that I had cancer. And just in the back of your mind, you're going, yeah, you're going to have to have something done now. But I still didn't really tell anyone.
Right. So at what point did you have the operation then?
When I got back from, was it Boston or the next one? From the long distance, I think they said, right, we need to do something about that. So I had the operation in July. And then it's not until like 2 weeks after the operation where they take biopsies that they tell you what they need to do as further treatment. So I was being the glass half full person that I tend to be. I'm like, yeah, the operation will have got rid of it. That's fine. That's the end of it. I'll just get over this operation. I'm still booked in for the world. I'm still booked in for Barcelona. All is good. And they said, yeah, well, chemo next.
So, you know, any time before, once you'd found out you needed an operation in the intervening period while you were still competing, did you have any side effects? Did you start to feel ill? Because my mum had cancer and died in 2000, and I know that she had what was called a cholangiocarcinoma, so it was sort of around the lymph nodes, and it was very rare, and there wasn't any known survivors, so it was going to be terminal. Ooh. But she found out that she had it. She wasn't feeling very well. She had pain in her stomach around her liver, and she said that she knew then that she had cancer before they diagnosed it. And so after that, it was a constant round of treatment. And while she did do stuff like, you know, she played a lot of badminton, she was nowhere near your level of sports person. She was very active, but she was often feeling ill. But before she had any ops, did you get anything like that?
No, nothing at all. I felt completely normal. The only hint that I had that something might not be right was that usually when I do marathon training, I drop a load of weight. And I wasn't losing any. If anything, I was putting it on. And the oncologist said, well, that may well be to do with the hormones. But no, I felt absolutely fine. I've never felt ill. I've never felt lumps. I've never had any issues at all like that.
So you had an operation. So mastectomy, single?
Mastectomy, single mastectomy.
Yeah.
Lymph node clearance.
Okay. And was there any follow-up surgery to that? I sort of remember from reading the article that John Levison wrote in Triathlon 24/7, which for the listeners, I will put in the show notes so you can read the full transcript of that. But he talks about there was one point where they wanted to take some muscle muscle from your leg and from your inner thigh, and obviously that would then affect your ability to ride as well as you do.
Well, you go through a series of seeing men in the medical profession, and why there aren't more women, it just defies explanation. But I stood half naked before a lot of men as they sized up my various muscles and fat residues to see what they could do. But there is no concept of what taking muscle does to an athlete. Because they said, they're like, oh, well, we'll just take your latissimus dorsi. I said, that's a fairly major muscle, isn't it? Oh, yeah. Well, no, you're not touching it. That's all right. We'll take a thigh muscle. No, I'll need that for the horses. Oh, it's fine. We'll take a stomach muscle. I don't think you will. And they just couldn't get the concept that I actually needed these muscles. And even when it got to the point where talking about having a reconstruction, they said, well, you know, if we can't use any of your muscle to do a reconstruction, what we could do is put an implant in, and then we'll just sever your pectoral muscle and slip it behind, at which point I nearly hit the ceiling. I said, you've just said you're going to cut my pectoral muscle in half. Do you not think I may need this at some stage? But it's just, that's the procedure, that's what they do. And I just happened to be able to say no and find a way through.
So what did they do?
They used an old technique they hadn't used for a long time, which is just to basically tack the implant on top of the pectoral muscle and cover it with a mesh, which is what holds it in place. Which is fine. So they didn't actually have to touch any major muscle groups, but they wanted to touch lots.
Oh, how close we were to not having an outlaw record breaker last year.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine what that would do to my swim.
Well, yeah, I mean, but then, you know, they were talking, whatever they were talking about doing would have affected some part of your triathlon performance, wouldn't it? You'd have had to carry on being a duathlete at that point, I get, or swimming with just one useful arm.
Yeah, we had a lot of jokes about whether I'd swim one-sided and ran in circles, or if I could maybe have a water carrier in place of the other muscle tissue, but you know, in the end, it's fairly standard.
So you'd had the operation, but then they said you need to have chemo. So and it makes it sound like I'm some sort of grim reaper here, but one of my best friends died last year of cancer, and I can recall going to visit him in hospital when he was having his chemo, and he was hooked quite strong chemo, and he was hooked up to these four bags of fluid, which looked like drinks dispensers in a bar. You know, one was a red, and he said, "Oh, that one's really nasty. That red one, this yellow one here, that's not too bad. The clear one, that's okay." Which just looked like a vodka drip. And then he said, "There's that one over there, which is some other colour." And when we went at night, he had all these little lights which were activating the pumps. And I said, "Well, what happens when they're empty?" And he said, "Oh, it's like all the Christmas bells going off."
Yeah, that's right. On the chemo ward, I think, most of it is punctuated by sirens of people's drips ending or starting or getting caught or something. Yes. All the sirens going off.
So you had to go in at regular intervals then, did you?
Yeah, I went in for a day every 3 weeks. Obviously, you have to have your bloods done before that, and there's various other trips in. But, they pump the poison into you.
And how many of those did you have to undergo?
It was it lasted 4 months. So I had four cycles.
That's quite a lot of poison into your body, isn't it? So, and this is the ironic thing. I was chatting to somebody else the other day who'd had leukemia, and he was saying, you know, that in order to get rid of something that's killing you, they have to give you something else that's likely to kill you as well.
That's our problem. They put the drugs in, but then all the drugs have side effects, and then the drugs they give you to counter the side effects have side effects of their own. So actually you end up taking, I mean, I came home with a trolley full of drugs, most of which, luckily for me, for various reasons, I didn't have to take. It's frightening, really frightening.
Yeah, when Mick passed on last year, his wife said I could start a drug dealer's den here. She said, "I've got so much stuff in here now," It's quite criminal, really, and she had to take it all back to the hospital and have them dispose of it. But
your triathlete mind is, of course, still in effect as I'm going in for my chemo.
Okay, Jill. So during the period of your chemo, you were doing some races, no triathlons, but you were doing cyclocross and some other little stuff, pottering around. Obviously, you were still active and training during this period then. So what effect did the chemotherapy drugs have on your training and on your recovery?
It was really interesting time, to be honest. I was intrigued to see what the drugs would do to me and how they affected me. And I probably did more than I should have done, because I was interested in the effect they had on me. The day after I had my first chemo, I went up to the Peak District and did 4 hours on the bike up and down the hills with a friend. And actually, because you've still got the steroids in your system, it wasn't too bad. But I think as I drove home, I know I was absolutely freezing and shaking all over, and I just couldn't stop shaking. I couldn't get warm. And that was the start of you lose control of your temperature. So sometimes you're really hot and sometimes you're absolutely bone cold, especially in the afternoon. Interestingly enough, you get really cold. So I had like thick chemo socks. But the effects of the drugs were different each time I had them. So the first time I had them, I got tremendous, tremendous bone pain, where it felt like my legs were falling off and I literally was floored. I was in the middle of Tesco one day and I literally couldn't move. My hips just seized up and I was stood there. And the other effect some of the drugs have is that you need to go to the toilet a little more often than not. So I'm stood in the middle of Tesco's thinking, the loser at the other end of the store, and my hips have seized up and I can't move. It wasn't one of my greatest moments. It's hilarious now, but it wasn't at the time.
Did you make it to the bathroom then?
I did in the end, luckily. But I did use a trolley to help me get there. So the bone pain was really bad that time. And I spoke to the oncologist about it. And she said, well, you could take painkillers, which hadn't even occurred to me, because it's putting drugs on top of more drugs. Mm. But I didn't get that dreadful bone pain again the next few times. I got a bit, but nothing quite so dreadful. But then I'd get other side effects. And in general, with the training, I found I could do pretty much what I wanted. I could go out cycling. I could go out running. I could mainly go swimming. But I could sort of go for a long time at a low pace. I had no engine. If I wanted to go up a hill, if I wanted to sprint, if I wanted to put any effort in, it just wasn't there. It's like the oxygen supply was cut off. And you could put all the effort in you like, and your head was still in it, but your body would just laugh at you. You'd sort of go, come on, let's go. And they'd go, yeah, maybe tomorrow.
I seem to remember reading that you felt like you'd got the engine of a 2CV rather than the Ferrari, which you'd had before.
That's it. Absolutely. Yeah. So whereas before, when you go racing, you know, you find a good threshold pace and then you want to kick for the end and you sprint and you think, yeah, I'm a Ferrari. I can go, you know, fast and I can keep this. It was like, yeah, I'm still a Ferrari, but actually they've changed the engine and I'm puttering along. It was very frustrating, but it was quite funny.
Probably not at the time, maybe looking back on it.
Yeah. But actually doing the cross country races that, you know, I do most years, and in the league, and the cyclocross races, it was a completely new perspective for me, because I'm usually up the pointy end being serious and thrashing it out with the ladies at the top or near the top somewhere. And I was at the back and I was puttering along, doing absolutely as much as I could and not really getting very far. But I was with a whole load of other people who race for enjoyment, and they race to get round, and they race because they can and because they enjoy it and because it's sociable. And it gave me a whole new perspective. And actually, when I thought about it, when I didn't look at my time at the end, I really enjoyed it. You know, I had my own battles at the back with other people, and it was it was a very eye-opening.
It's all about the time you had, not the time you did.
Yeah, it had to be. because I think, I mean, usually with, especially with the cross country series, you know, you get in and you get a ticket to say where you came, and it's usually like one, two or three in the cross country series. And I think my first ticket was like 232. I had a little moment at that one.
did you ever get that thought in your mind that actually, do you know what, compared to what I've just been through, I'm glad to be doing something?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. That was why I was there.
Yeah.
And I was partly there because although you feel you ought to avoid big social gatherings because you're so worried about your immune system, I also really needed people, and I needed some normality, and I needed to be part of something, and that gave me it. And my running club and the cycle club and the people I compete with are my friends. They're my community. They're my support. And even if they didn't know what I was going through, although some must have suspected something, they were there for me, and they provided that bit of normality that I didn't have through the rest of my life, and a bit of control. This was me saying, yes, I'm going through this, but you know, I can still do something. I can still get out, and I can still enjoy myself, and I can still be part of the world that I'm used to being part of, even if it's not quite at the same place.
Did you tell your medical professionals, you know, your oncologist, your surgeon, any of the nurses that you were seeing regularly for chemotherapy, did you mention to them that you were continuing with these athletic pursuits and that you were going to come back afterwards, or did they just suggest that you perhaps try and find something a little gentler?
My oncologist was the first lady I'd come across in the whole process, and she was amazing. I wrote down two sides of A4 when I first met her, and I wrote it down because I didn't think I'd be in an emotional state to articulate what I wanted to say. So I wrote it down, and she read it, and she looked at me and she said, Jill, whatever you want to do, go and do it. And I sort of breathed a big sigh of relief and said, oh, thank you. But yeah, when I turned up having, you know, run a cross-country race and gone in the next day or that week for chemo, and they said, oh, what have you been doing? Oh, yeah, I did the cross-country the weekend and I did this. And they're like jaws would drop and hit the floor. And the most, you know, people generally recommend you to do is oh, go for a little walk. You can go for a walk. Try and go for a walk every day. And so for some people, do you know, some people can only go for a walk, and I'm not saying by any means that everyone should get up and compete while they're doing chemo, because you genuinely can't. And there were days when I sat in bed and I couldn't, but when I could, I did. And I'm very, very fortunate that my state of health beforehand made me quite resilient, and my fitness helped me through no end, and I got through the process in a lot, lot better state than a lot of other people. And, you know, my oncologist actually said I could take my turbo into the chemo ward when I was having chemo, because I said I was getting really cold with my cold cap on, and I thought that would keep me warm and keep me busy. And she's saying, yeah, yeah, go for it. But there were other people in there who were suffering so much, I really didn't think it was right in the end.
I've seen a photograph of you wearing a cap and it looks like you've got rabbit ears. And is that, yes, that's the cold cap you talk about? What was that all about then?
Well, there's because I hadn't told anyone apart from family, obviously, or some family. I wanted to try and keep my hair if I could. And the one thing you can do to try and keep your hair is wear a cold cap, which is basically a cap with tubes in that they pump ice around. It's incredibly painful. just like having your head frozen for however many hours you sit there. So that went on just to try and maintain the hair. It's a more a vanity thing than anything else, to be honest.
Did it work?
It did to a certain extent. I lost quite a lot of hair, but I also maintained enough hair to just be almost normal.
But it's all come back now, though, so...
Oh, yeah, it's come back really thick and bushy and curly. I've never had curly hair.
Excellent.
I have trouble keeping it down now.
let's just talk about that moment when you found out. You know, let's say that, because there's, you know, I guess as triathletes, we all feel that we're invincible. But there will be people who are listening to this who... sadly may sort of encounter this sort of experience in their future. You know, what's your advice on how to deal with it? Well, on top of what you've already said, but you know, if what are the steps that you'd take if somebody close to you it happened to?
The first thing you've got to do is take your time, because when you get a diagnosis, the medical profession want to, obviously it's their job to keep you alive. They want to do things as quickly as possible. But that puts you under a lot of pressure to make decisions, life-changing decisions, very quickly. And you're very much put on the conveyor belt and you go from station to station. You see one person, this is what we do. You're the next, but this is what we do. And you go along it. And you're like a rabbit in the headlights. You get, oh yeah, they're professionals. They know what they're doing. They must be right. No, they're not always right for you. And you need to just take a step back and look at the options that you have and see if there are any other options. That's what I have to do with the muscles. It's like, so if I don't want these muscles cut, what else can I do? How can I still have the treatment but go about it a slightly different way? So I would say step off the conveyor belt, get a perspective, get an opinion, talk to your friends, talk to other people, and see what you can do to make the process work for you. It's very individual.
And I guess that individuality extends to how you respond to it in terms of what exercise you do, because as you said, you know, there are some people who couldn't do what you did, but you did manage to do it. So I guess that everybody's an individual, because each type of cancer, although you can be globally diagnosed with having a breast cancer, each of them is slightly different. It affects different organs. It has a different speed of aggression of the disease. And then there's the individual and their own physical state, their age, and also their mindset. And so each situation is new. So going back through the research data saying, well, you know, on average, 75% of people respond like this, that's no good. Each case is unique. And so you have to find your own way of getting through it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I was lucky enough to be able to keep training, keep active, keep doing. But I'm not the only one, especially since that interview with John Leveson. I've had lots of people contact me who also have trained and raced and competed and done more than me, in fact, through their chemo, through their radiotherapy, things like this. And there are a million amazing, inspiring people out there. And hopefully we can tap into that.
And you've started this organisation and this website called cancerfit.me. I'd like to come back to that in a moment, Jill, if I can, just to finish off. But let's just talk about your return to triathlon then. So it was 2016, wasn't it? Was it 2016 when you finished your treatment, or did it extend over into the new year?
No, it finished just before Christmas 2016.
Okay. So
I started training in January 2017.
Okay, and then what was your race schedule like then for 2017? Did you go back in gradually, or did you just go head first?
Well, if it had been down to me, I'd obviously have gone in head first. But luckily, 2017, I signed back up with Perry Agas, who I'd had to unsign with before while I was going through the treatment. And he kept me on a very, very tight leash coming back, where I'd been going off and doing like 10 mile runs at really steady pace and doing long bikes and so forth. He's like, right, you can do half an hour on your bike today. I'm like, please, Barry, let me do more. No. So he brought me in very carefully. And in hindsight, obviously, that was absolutely the right thing to do, because we built a really steady base. We avoided injury. We took account of the immune system and gradually letting the drugs out of the system, because they can take sort of 3 months to get out of the system. And by March, I did the British Duathlon Champs, which they very handily hold about 2 miles from my house. So I was allowed to do that. And I went out and won that and thought, you know, I'm on the way back. This is good.
And 4 months later, they were at Outlaw. Was it nine?
Well, I did the half before that, the Nottingham half.
Yeah.
I won that.
Did you win that? You won that overall, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a dream year. It was really ridiculous, just ridiculous.
And 9:44 at the Outlaw, new course record. And there's been some big names on that record list. So you were in esteemed company there, and giving the other ladies a few years as well. So that was an astounding comeback. And then, so what have you been up to since winning that race last year?
Since winning that, I went on from Outlaw and did because I'd had to cancel Ironman Barcelona in 2016. I went back and did it in 2017, and won my age group there. I did a very similar time to Outlaw, just very slightly quicker, which was nice to sort of confirm that I could do that time more than once, and it was established.
Does that mean you're going to Kona this year then?
Yeah.
Ah, good. Well, we'll see you out there then.
Oh, cool. Brilliant. Yeah. No, I'm lot of trepidation because Kona is such a tough ask, such a tough course. But yeah, really looking forward to it in a quietly terrified kind of way.
Cool. So clearly, in terms of your physical fitness, your recovery is about complete. Where are you now with the cancer and being in remission? Because is it right you have to have 5 years before they sort of sign you off?
I obviously get checked out once a year. Cancer's one of those things I don't think you can ever say goodbye to it. I think it's there, and you live every day with the thought that it could recur. It could recur in the same place. It could come back as something else. And quite often it's, you know, the recurrences that are more aggressive and difficult to get rid of than the initial diagnosis with whatever you have. So I live every day with the thought that, wondering whether it's coming back, when it's coming back. But you can't let that rule your head. It's there, it's a thought, it's in the back of my mind, it's always there. In the meantime, I'm bloody well going to get on with life and do as much as I can. So it gives you a sort of very go up and, you know, get out and do it kind of attitude.
Absolutely. And you were, we talked a bit about your training before you had cancer. Is your training regime fairly similar, or has it had to change?
Oh, well, it's very different, but it's nothing to do with the cancer. It's all to do with the coach. So now I'm with Perry. The Trisotto type training method is really hugely different to what I was doing before. But then what I was doing wasn't terribly structured. It was, you know, I'll do whatever the running club does here, and I'll do whatever the cycling club does here, and I'll throw some swimming in. So I wasn't very structured. I was just a bit gung-ho. So now it's much more structured. But I'm really, really enjoying learning about how you can do things differently, and economy of training, and putting effort in and not putting effort in, and different pacing. And yeah, not having to be out there for a million hours necessarily, as long as you're putting the effort in the right places. And the coach will be amazed to hear me saying anything vaguely sensible.
What is it about the training? Does it follow a more of a polarized approach? So lots of easy stuff and some very specific hard stuff.
Yeah. Yes, sort of. They have moderate, medium, and mad.
Yeah, I've heard, and they're not against gadgets, but they very much of the idea that you should be able to do things by feel.
I'm not asked for any. I'm very rarely asked for splits, times, powers, anything like that. And you do a lot by feel. But that sort of follows, because if you have a really heavy training week, then you're going to be tired the next week. So if you're asked to go at the same pace as a mad on when you've had a fresh week, you're not going to be able to do it. So you're going to end up depressed. and chasing something that isn't possible or may be getting injured. So actually, when you do it on field, I'm still putting the full effort in. Some days I'll get a great time. Some days I'll get a rubbish time. It depends on the cumulative effect of what I've done, how well I've slept, what my diet's been like, life. It's a big learning curve, but I'm really enjoying it.
It's very alien to what a lot of triathletes who are coming into this sport late are doing. You know, driven or led by gadgets. But actually, if you talk to coaches and athletes who've been in the sport for 30 years or more, they will say that this is how we always used to do stuff. You know, everybody used to go on field. I can remember there was a guy called, I don't know if you remember him, Jill, he might have been before your time, but you might have heard about Pauli Kiuru, who was a Finnish guy. And because Polar were a Finnish company, he was one of their pinup boys. And everything he used to do was by heart rate monitor. And I remember Dave Scott telling a story about Pauli. He was winning in Kona one year, and he could have won, but his heart rate monitor was telling him he was going too fast, so he slowed down. And I think it might even have been Mark Allen that overtook him in one of his sort of second or third victories when he came from behind. But actually, Pauli had it within it. He said afterwards, I had it within myself to run, but my heart rate monitor was telling me I was going too fast. So I ran to that, and Mark caught me, and that was it. He came second. But before then, everything was done on field. And I'm not sure that performances were any much worse then than they are now, because people...
No, and especially in the race. Yeah. When you're racing, I'm pretty much giving it what I've got. Looking at a watch isn't going to help me. Sometimes I'll have a look to see if what I'm feeling is what is actually happening. If I'm just having a slack period or whether I need to push a bit more. But generally, that's what I've got at that moment. If I can run faster, I will, and if I can't, I won't. And no gadget in the world is going to make me any faster.
Yeah. I suppose it might slow you down if you set off too fast. But again, if you've done the right sort of training and practiced getting the right pace, again, you shouldn't need that. I mean, look at the guys that do the pacing for the world records on the track. In the olden days, they used to be able to hit splits within tenths of a second without having any reference to a timing device.
I mean, I do fall foul of that. I go off too hard and die. But actually, sometimes I think you can frighten yourself out of a good performance as well by looking at your watch and going, oh, that's, you know, I'm 6 minute miling. I shouldn't be doing that because I can't maintain it. Well, how do you know you can't maintain it till you've given it a go?
Well, how many people do you know, and I'm sure you do, where they've crossed the line and going, well, how did that happen? How did I didn't know I was capable of that? Well, that's clearly you were capable of it, and what stopped you in the past is either your mind telling you to slow down, or the gadgets indicating you're going too fast, or perhaps just being a bit too tired, and when you're suddenly rested up and feeling fresh, all of this fitness you have comes flooding out.
Yeah.
But most people never give themselves a chance to find that out, because there's always something somewhere restricting them.
Yeah, our coach is very much on, you know, you've got to be prepared to lose to win. So you've got to be prepared to risk something. And if you never risk something, then you're never really going to push your boundaries. Unless you go out and push something and see where you can get, you're never going to know where you can get.
It's the Alistair Brownlee method, isn't it, of die trying. Don't come across the line not dying and thinking you could have done more. Just give it everything, and if you fail, then fine. But who knows where it might lead. And
I think a lot of people race mediocre because that's what that stays within their comfort zone.
Yeah, indeed. Right, Jill, I realise that I've kept you on the line far too long. So before you go, I do want to just talk a little bit more about this new project of yours, which we are going to share on the Facebook pages. And if anybody's listening, please do, having listened to Jill's story, I'm sure that, you know, we've seen the statistics that cancer's affecting between 1 in 3 and between 30% and 50% of the population at some stage in their life. So there's going to be times when it affects somebody that you know, or even you. Please take time to visit Jill's new site, which is called cancerfit.me. So Jill, this is your opportunity to just explain exactly what your goal is with this new project.
cool. It's a great forum to do that. Thank you for letting me talk about it. And it's definitely not just me. I'm a minor cog in this, really. You'll all know Lucy Gossage, incredibly passionate triathlete, incredibly passionate cancer doctor. Liz Riordan is also a triathlete. She's also a cancer doctor who knows Lucy. And Tanya Slater, big triathlete, triathlon coach, triathlete. Between the four of us, we all come to cancer from a different angle. Two of us having had it, two of them being triathletes, two of them being oncologists. And between the four of us, I'm not quite sure how it happened, but this little baby popped out, which is CancerFit, which is a website designed to support people who have been diagnosed with cancer, who have cancer, who are going through treatment and post-cancer all the way through. Because all of us said there is no facility anywhere to find stories of other people who've had cancer and have exercised through it, who've raced through it, what they've been able to do, what they haven't been able to do. And most of the medical profession are so risk averse that they'll say, don't do anything more than walk. I was told I could walk after my operation. I'm like, I don't walk anywhere. And there was nothing to tell me what I could do and what I couldn't do, what was healthy, what wasn't. And what we want to do is, A, put people in touch with each other. So people who are going through this horrible process can share it and can get some support from other people. We want to put some expert advice in there. So if you've got a question, you can ask an expert and get a proper opinion on something. It's going to be huge, and we are so, so proud of it. We're just trying to find get some funding behind it now so we can really put the proper facilities in place that we need to, because it's a very, very important thing, and it helps people get through cancer. Being fit and healthy, I know, made my journey so much easier, and I'd like other people, A, to have the support of others going through it, B, to have some proper advice about what they should and shouldn't do and what the drugs do, and just to have the passion of people helping you there and knowing that there are positive outcomes and you can get through it and you can go on and you can do more than you were doing before, not just go back to being what you were. You can use it to help you be stronger.
So I guess this would also be very useful for the significant others of those who are currently going through the treatment, because it will help them to understand what they can and can't do and what effect the drugs have, and maybe that's something that some people aren't comfortable in chatting about with those closest to them, but reading about it will allow them to understand a little bit more, and perhaps a little bit more about the mindset of people who are currently undergoing treatment.
Yeah, it gives you an idea of what to expect. So when you expect something, it's then not a shock or a surprise, and you can plan for it and you can deal with it. It's when things come out of the blue and people don't tell you what's going to happen. Like one of the things that happened when I was on my chemo was my eyesight got drastically worse. And I went in one day and said, look, I'm not sure I'm safe driving because my eyesight's not great. And she says, oh, don't worry. Your lenses will harden through the drugs, but when you come off the chemo, they'll go back to normal. And I'm like, why didn't anybody tell me that? There was me absolutely terrified that I was losing my sight, and I'm not. And it's stuff like that. And if you can read it and go, oh, so okay, so I might have to be careful driving. I might sort of temporarily have to get some glasses or something, but it's all going to be fine. You can plan for something and you know what's going on. And what you say about the other halves is absolutely true, because I think when you're going through it yourself, you deal with it and you sort of internalize and you have a plan and you know how you're going to deal with it. But for other people, because it's not them undergoing it, they feel very powerless and they can feel very left out. And it's a very, very difficult position to be in. And to have somewhere you can go and look at other people dealing with it and how other halves deal with it, I think that could be a really good facility.
Wow. That does sound like a brilliantly innovative project. And you know, when you're talking about it in so articulately like that, you wonder, well, why has nobody come up with this before? Because this isn't a new thing for athletes, is it?
No, there are various odd things around the world, because when we were looking for names and so forth, we came across various initiatives. There's some great cycling initiatives. I'm really sorry that I don't remember names well, but there are some brilliant people out there who have got exercise related websites and activities and so forth going on. But they're very insular. They're quite isolated, and there's nothing that links them together. So if we can put a load of links in and go, you can go and do this, you can go here for support, this is another organisation that will help you. And we're hoping we can actually get people together and maybe do some sort of cancer-related, some park runs or some sponsored cycles or, you know, stuff like that. Get people together so they're talking and becomes a community. And it's not such a black hole anymore, and people aren't worried about it.
Amazing. I'm sort of silenced, and for those people who know me, they'll say that that's a very rare occurrence.
Lucy would be one of them.
So just to repeat, cancerfit.me.
Yeah,
that's the website. Let's say that there's somebody who's listened to this podcast, Jill, and has either just been diagnosed or is currently going through the same thing as you. Are they able to contact you directly for not for guidance, but maybe some support, or would you just recommend that they go to the website?
Well, the website is set up to provide support and guidance. I'm one person. I've had my own experiences. I have no clue about other. I don't know about radiotherapy. I don't know about other types of cancer. I'm just a normal person who's gone through it, and there are lots of us. But the website, the email address works, and that comes through to all of us. So there's a general email address, and we will all see your emails, and they will be responded to. At the minute, the site is just a holding site telling you what's going to be there. We've got a website guy designing it for us as we speak. And like I say, we're looking into funding, and it should be up and running as soon as we can possibly do it. But yes, you can still get hold of us now, and you can still get an email, and you will get a response.
Do you know the email off the top of your head?
Oh, God, if you've asked me this beforehand, I would have told you.
I'm guessing it's something at Cancer
website.
Yeah,
it will be on there.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. When we finish this call, I will go to the CancerFit website, and I will get that email address.
There we go. It's hello@cancerfit.me.
Okay, so you've saved me a job. And we will put that in the show notes as well.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
We'll publicise this on my Facebook pages. And Jill, I can't say thank you enough. It's been amazing chatting to you. I've met you several times at the finish line. You do always look a lot more smiley than you said you did. But it's been an absolute pleasure. It's an inspirational story. I hope that the listeners have found it as inspirational as I have. I will link to the Try 24/7 article that John Levison so passionately wrote, because John's also a cancer survivor, so he has a sort of a shared experience with you.
He was superb, because he knows what you're talking about, and he was just great.
Yeah, so I'll link to that as well. But thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Simon. I'm really honoured that you wanted to talk to me, because I'm just me. I'm no one special. I'm certainly not superhuman, but I do hope I can inspire some people to find a passion and find a bit of strength if they're going through tough stuff.
Well, I'm sure you'll have done that, and I look forward to seeing you out in Kona in a few weeks' time.
Bit more
sunshine for us to enjoy at the end of a nice summer.
Absolutely. You have to catch me over the finish line as I collapse.
Well, I will be there catching, actually, but I think perhaps I'll be on after your expected finish. Anyway, listeners, this has been an exceptional interview. It's a little longer than normal. If you've stayed on this far, I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've been inspired. Thanks very much for listening. I do appreciate the fact that there are other podcasts out there for you to go to, and that you choose to listen to this one each week. We will have more inspiring and exciting and amazing guests coming up. But for now, from myself and Jill Fullan, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.